Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 753, and it's May the 12th, 1986. A listener to this program from Santa Cruz sent me a letter to the editor written to a small publication called Leviathan, and it's written by John Loftus, who wrote The Valeris Secret, and it's a letter asking for help. And it sort of describes about what's going on in this country. I'm going to share it with you, and you can send for the address. I'll give it on the air one time, and its telephone number. Maybe you can follow through on this, and if I go too fast, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to me, Mae Brussel, P.O. Box 225-11-93922, and I'll have more information for you. John Loftus wrote to just the Leviathan, "Dear friends, I need your help. I'm a former war crimes prosecutor for the Justice Department, the only one in the last 40 years permitted to research the Nazi connections to top government archives. For 6 years, my wife and I have tried to expose how the United States intelligence agencies protected Nazi war criminals, and they also brought them here and hired them then. I broke this story in 1982 on 60 Minutes, with an Emmy Award. My History of Nazi Smuggling Programs, The Valeris Secret, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. In the last 3 years, I have given lectures, testified before the House Judiciary Committee, and had created a special congressional commission to investigate Nazi war criminals. He said, for the past 2 years, my wife has been crippled. She was attacked by a psychiatric patient. And this is where the retribution comes down on these people. She was attacked by a patient. She's crippled for the rest of her life. We had to mortgage our home to keep the research going. The financial pressures are unbearable. Congressional groups are requesting more and more assistance, which takes me away from my law practice. I've never requested donations before, but now I need help. Please send to the Loftus Fund, 372 Spring Street, Rockland, Maryland, 02370. You can call him 617, area code 617-871-0168 or 871-6312. Now, Mr. Blair, who wrote a book on the oil conspiracies, he was dead just about the week that his book came out. And Mr. Borkin, who wrote The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, was dead the book that his, time and date that his book came out, and a gentleman who wrote on the exposures of Reverend Moon and testified for congressional committees and headed those committees, he was dead when that book came out. There's a pattern of killing these authors and getting rid of them so that they don't do tours and promote their books, but John Loftus has been very visible, and one of the worst things you can do, I mean, it's pretty bad to kill the author and the researcher, but when you maim somebody and make her crippled for life, it is horrendous. So I'm passing this on to you, and thank you, the listener who sent that to me. Last week, I talked about the Chernobyl reactor and was there sabotage. And I believe, by the way, the news read, the reactions, and the way this thing happened, I believe that it was purposely sabotage for one of many, almost 50 or 60 good reasons, and I continue to believe that. And I'll update that for you later. This past week, there was an article titled "Soviets Blame Human Error." They admit the damage was widespread. And then there was a press conference and an editorial article written by Mr. Andronik Petrosyan from the Soviet Union titled "Highly Improbable Factors Cause Chemical Explosion." And he said, "So far, I cannot name the exact cause of the accident. The processing will take a long time. I can say with absolute certainty there is no nuclear explosion. It is more probable a chemical explosion took place. I know this is a serious accident. We have had nothing like it since we began the nuclear industry. The accident was caused by a combination of highly improbable technical factors, and I cannot speak with certainty, but we are inclined to believe that personnel made mistakes that complicated the situation. The principles of individual operations must have been misused." That was an understatement of the year, and I understand they have moved out certain people involved with this who could have taken earlier actions, but by not taking those, they became the subject of scorn throughout the world, and just at the time that the president was, and I say the president because he runs the summit meetings or gets so much attention here, was in Japan ready with the summit, and he could talk about the Soviet Union. One of the matters that is very, very important that I've talked about on World Watcher is not enough and should do more, I'm going to bring it up again, is the relocation of the Navajos. You can write to your congressman. Here's some more homework besides reaching John Loftus. If you haven't called or if you can, write to members of Congress, the Senate and Congress, on the consequences of Public Law 93-531. July the 8th is the date that the Indians, the Navajo Indians, are to be relocated, particularly into Flagstaff. They don't speak English. There's a lot of alcoholism and liquor problems, drugs with the American Indians as soon as they leave the reservations. The Committee on Interior, the House Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, reported just 2 months ago, March 25th, 1985, that the Indian Relocation Commission program is not working. They referred to the Appropriations Committee. The Relocation Act would cost taxpayers $1.5 billion, but that's the least of it. You know, just the resettlement is $1.5 billion. But they don't have jobs, and many people, they're dying of broken hearts. And this was something that was set up in 1974 by the Nixon administration and then Gerald Ford, and under the land where the American Indians live in this area is uranium. Uranium will be used for Star Wars, for atomic bombs, and the karma of removing these people will have to come back to us now. We can worry about Hands Across America feeding people. Feeding people isn't the problem. The summit had a problem with a surplus of food. There's too much food. It's in the state of the mind of the very people running this country, and you have to deal with that. There are a lot of people on the peninsula and elsewhere, right where I live, the so-called, I call them the professional liberals, who cry when these things come down and really quickly want to do something in El Salvador or do something for the American Indians, and they get together and have their socials and their boo-hoos. But the important thing, and they don't believe that, is the way that Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford got power, even through the murder of John Kennedy. If they investigated it properly, they would remove these people from making decisions of relocating the Indians. Jack Anderson had an article last week, and also there was an editorial in one of the newspapers on another threat for American Indians. Jack Anderson said that there are 12 possible sites for nuclear waste from the atomic energy facilities and from the weapons factories, and 5 of the 12 are on American Indian reservations that will be possible dumping grounds. And in one article I have last week, April 28th, is titled, Another Threat for Indians. And it says, since a European set foot in the New World, American Indians have been squeezed into smaller plots of barren land. Now the federal government has proposed that crystalline rock underlying 5 of their reservations could be used as subterranean dumps for highly radioactive nuclear waste. Lawyers want to block the proposal. They are outraged. The government is looking for 2 places to entomb thousands of tons of spent reactor fuel from the country's nuclear power plants. The waste is dangerously radioactive. It will last for thousands of years. The U.S. Department of Energy has selected a dozen potential sites in 8 states, and 5 of them are on Indian reservations. The Indians on reservations are profoundly impoverished. They're discriminated against. They're short-lived. And for them, the meaning of life is still drawn from their land, their tribal home, and their kin, and they hold this in common. The Indian reservation encompasses some of the least hospitable ground in this country, granted, but this is where generations of Indians have been able to live with sacred ground, and their ancestral bones are buried there, and now all of a sudden they're going to put 5 of the 12 locations for dumping nuclear waste would be on reservations of the American Indians. There is a movie called The Broken Rainbow that won an Academy Award this past year. If you get a chance and live in a large enough city, we don't have it here in Carmel, and I haven't seen it on any movie billboards when I'm down in L.A., try and see the movie. It's about the relocation of the Indians, and 25% of these people have already died. Countless others have been evicted by unscrupulous ways. The dispersal of 15,000 Navajos is being justified. as a dispute between the Hopis and the Navajos, and this movie tells you about it. A terrible article in the Washington Post, April 26, titled Distortion of Despair, putting down the fact of the plight of the Navajo Indians and their relocation. LA Times, May 1, 1986, had a story, American Indians found three times more likely to die young. Well, they are given tremendous problems, little health care, and now there can be a complete genocide where they're pushed out totally, and that isn't surprising. Jack Anderson also had an article, May 1st, Malaria Scourges World Bank Project, and this is about the Indians in Brazil. And he said the environmental experts have predicted disaster if the World Bank encouraged Brazil's ambitious landowners in the Amazon rainforest to continue with what they're doing. The state of Rondônia is in the heart of a World Bank project. The controversial jungle clearing scheme has been possible because so far $500 million in loans have come from the World Bank. One-fifth of that money comes from the United States. They moved a large number of Indians into the area, 500,000, and told them the land was cheap and they'd have a bright future. This has been going on for 4 years. They found out the soil was bad, there's violence in the area, and furthermore, 200,000 now have malaria, and it's a very dangerous, virulent strain. And Jack Anderson was saying that Senator Robert Caston, Jr., Wisconsin, was asking that the World Bank stop sending more money because it can really be translated into a genocide for the Indians. Now, this same representative from Wisconsin, Mr. Caston, Senator Caston, was concerned about Brazilian Indians. I have an article about Wisconsin Indians that were forced with eviction by Exxon. This goes back to 1981. Is the plight of Indians being in an area in Wisconsin close to Mole Lake. They were kicked off all their other lakes and reservations, and that's where they grow wild rice and support themselves. And Exxon came in May 1976. This was 2 years after the decision to move the Navajos out of Big Mountain into Flagstaff and get them off of their holy sacred territory. This again goes through the Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Nelson Rockefeller era. In 1976, they were drilling 70 holes in the ground less than a mile from the Mole Lake Reservation. They discovered the richest mineral deposits in the world, 75 million tons of sulfur, iron, pyrite, which is valuable for zinc and copper, traces of silver and gold, and then Exxon started to drill, which would cause Mole Lake to be devastated. And the excuse was that the Exxon needed these minerals, and again, they can use them for military purposes and for profit and money and push these poor Indians. And one of the other things in this study was uranium is found in metal deposits. And once again, Exxon, with Nelson Rockefeller, became vice president after Watergate. Crook Nixon appointed Gerald Ford, and Ford had Rockefeller, the head of Exxon, as vice president, and they took an area of 12 square miles close to lakes where the rice were growing, supported the tribes up in Wisconsin, and just literally took over. They need that Mole Lake for survival, and you know, Exxon came in and pushed them away so that it's easy for a member of the Senate to worry about the World Bank and malaria and genocide of Brazilian Indians. But I'd have to go back and look up what Senator Caston did at the time in Wisconsin. You can, as I say, send a message to your congressman, one of these overnight letters, or just, I think it's better than telephoning the office. Stop PL, that's the bill, 93-531, as soon as you can. If you haven't sent a letter, please do that and let them know how you feel about it, if you're sufficiently angry. The Washington Post had a story April 20th, Wanted, an elite corps of assassins. And there are quotations from the book, The Last Hero, about Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS. This was Anthony Cave Brown's book. I've quoted that book quite a bit and cited a lot of things, particularly the British American Canadian Corporation, which was Permandex, foreign Permandex, with the assassination teams to kill those people that were in the way of corporations, of rearming Germany, and getting ready literally for World War III, pulling all the various countries together and killing heads of states. And in this country, the most notorious Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King. Finally, the Washington Post had a quotation from the book, "Wanted, the elite corps of assassins, U.S. agents' modest proposal for saving the world from collapse." And you don't see this printed in the national media very much, but they talk about a particular person who worked in the OSS, an agent named Carlton Kuhn, who's described in this book, and he told Mr. Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS, that we need a group of people that will do murders. He said that there's a clearer and objective mind that could prevail in this new technological society. We need some other power, some third class of individuals, aside from the leaders and scholars, specifically the assassins. And this third class has to have the task of thwarting mistakes, of diagnosing areas of potential world disequilibrium, and nipping the cause of potential disturbances in the bud. There must be a body of men whose task it is to throw out the rotten apples as soon as the first spots of decay appear. Now, this was happening in 1945, 46, 47, and the CIA was formed by 1947. And Mr. Carlton Kuhn was telling Mr. Donovan, you know, from the OSS and then the CIA, that you need this group of people, a third class. Your first class are your leaders, your second class are your scholars, and your third class are your assassins. And those are the three groups of people that you need to keep the Western world escalating at the pace it's going right now. He said, a body of this nature must exist undercover. It must be either be a power unto itself or been given the broadest discretionary powers by the highest human authorities. The only organizations in existence today which have even the rudiments of what it is needed in this formation are the body of men from the OSS and SOE, that's the British Special Operations Group. And that is the group set up by William Stevenson that became the network of the assassins, known and described in the Torbett document as the Permandex Operation. The SOE was the British counterpart in the OSS. And in this book, it refers to, again, the book on Raymond Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, not Raymond Donovan, the Secretary of Labor, but he was part of the Permandex operation and the Jimmy Hoffa wipeout and the control. That's another subject. But the two Donovans weren't far removed from the entire Permandex operation. But this quotation from the book says, the agents of these two organizations from British intelligence and American are trained to act undercover, to act ruthlessly without fear. We include objective scientists in our midst, and men with the widest experience of political, economic, and diplomatic fields. And the scientists are the important ones because of the Hughes Medical Institute, of DuPont, of Roman Haas, of I.G. Farben. We will use objective scientists. And then this article continues the quotation. It seems, therefore, to me, not too wild, too visionary, or too improbable a thought to suppose that from these groups, a smaller group will be selected, a group of men, sober-minded, without personal ambition, men competent to judge the needs of our world society and take whatever steps are necessary to prevent this society from a permanent collapse. Now, that was part of the book on Wild Bill Donovan, The Last Hero, and last week and many weeks before, I've cited their intention to go into bacteriological warfare, chemical warfare, and there are different ways of breaking up facilities and institutions, and this elite corps of assassins was indeed formed. There was an article in February I didn't have time to put on the air. I have many, many thousands of back articles. This is from the Houston Post. CIA report contends the rebels are not equipped to slit enemy throats. Contras lack knives? Well, all you have to do is to open the Soldier of Fortune magazines and see about the mercenaries that go all over the world, or Gung Ho, or any of these military magazines, and they are wall-to-wall issues of knives and how to cut throats and so forth. Defense of the CIA or the Contras not cutting throats of the various people in Central America was thrown, they tried to throw it out by saying that they didn't have enough knives to cut throats which is absolutely ridiculous because cutting throats is a favorite method of killing prisoners. This was in the same article from Houston Post that somebody said, and they have affidavits from Nicaraguan Americans who witnessed people having throats cut and human rights abused. And that, again, goes along not only with killing heads of states, but individuals. Now, there's just a few articles I'm going to run down, just the titles of them so quickly, because I want to get on to other material, but I can't help pass them up. One was the New York Times, May the 1st, President Asserts His Military Role. Ronald Reagan has sent a message to Congress warning against infringing against the votes that the Joint Chief of Staff of the Pentagon wants. Another item is Ronald Reagan having a formal portrait with Emperor Hirohito. Our First Lady is sitting on a chair, all smiles with her hands crossed, in her long flowing white gown, and there's the President of the United States, about 6 feet tall, with Mr. Hirohito. He looks like he's 4 feet tall, just up to his shoulder. This is a formal portrait with the Reagan's pose with Hirohito at the Imperial Palace banquet. And next to it on the same page is an item that Reagan refused to visit Hiroshima when he was in Japan, that he didn't want to go see that, but he would, in fact, have dinner at the Royal Palace with Hirohito. He didn't want anything to do with giving any recognition to the atomic bomb or worrying about nuclear disarmament. That's not on his mind. Quickly, the new ambassador to Brazil has been named. President Reagan intends to send Harry Schlotterman. This is his personal envoy in Central America, will be ambassador to Brazil. We'll remember the murder of the president of Brazil last year and the change of the guard due to political assassination, such as the Permandex operation. Mr. Schlotterman is a person I did broadcast about, not in the last year, but the year before, maybe with his role in Central America. He was very important in the murder of Salvador Allende. He is part of Kissinger's team, Henry Kissinger and Fritz Kramer. He's probably one of the most dangerous men around planet Earth besides Vernon Walters and William Casey. He's now been sent to Brazil. He will be sent to Brazil as ambassador. We no sooner get rid of somebody like John Gavin in Mexico as ambassador, who was a total disaster, then Reagan counteracts by making a one appointment that is 10 times worse, and sending Schlotterman to Brazil is horrendous. A brief article in the paper this last week, Mr. Waldheim, Kurt Waldheim, praised Hitler in reports that he wrote in a doctoral thesis in 1944. He praised Adolf Hitler. Another article, New York Times, May 2nd, Israel urges public access to UN war files. Did it ever dawn on anybody why Israel didn't want to see who those war criminals were? As I say, the UN has a list of 40,000, and Mr. Waldheim is just one of them, and they waited till 1986, 40 years, to ask about those files. Another story, Edward Teller urges more funds for Star War programs. Edward Teller, the physicist who helped President Reagan sell Star Wars, told Congress that they should increase their spending, not cut, and don't give it to any missile defense. We need it for Star Wars. He helped Ronald Reagan, March 23, 1983, initiate Star Wars. He had worked with him since 1966 when Reagan was governor of California. Another article, no evidence Contras are involved in drug trafficking, which is another outright lie. All they have to do is open up the secret papers, the court records in San Francisco that are locked up. Of course, there's no evidence when material is locked up, but if they would open the material that's locked up, they would find the evidence of the drug trafficking. The Washington Post has a story, April 27th, 1986. It's two and a half pages. Reagan's People issues a propriety. The Deaver case revives questions about senior officials in conduct. It's written by Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post, April 27th, 1986. It lists about 60 people that are into all kinds of trouble and mismanagement, and they are horrendous scandals. And they don't even include, this article doesn't include matters such as William Casey, the CIA director, being the attorney for Mr. and Mrs. Marcos and setting up dummy fronts in Panama to get tax skimming benefits and not paying the state of New York, or their role with Jay Dominelli in the San Diego scam. This barely scratches the surface, and when Reagan's out of office, there will be years of books and stories about these scandals. I maybe share some of this with you, but many of you do go to the library and follow up some of these articles, and you can look that up. It's a long, long story that deserves 52 weeks of airtime, an hour a week on each person, and I try to hit some of the major people time to time. Now, just to update the Challenger investigation, which has been going on for a long time. A few key articles this week. April 30th, San Francisco Examiner, probe finds Challenger sure to fail. Now, if you haven't heard my 7 or 8 broadcasts on the space shuttle program and the Challenger, you can't appreciate their conclusions here. But the committee is ready to turn in their report, and this article says an O-ring seal on the space shuttle Challenger was almost certain to fail because of faulty design and near-freezing weather the morning of the launch. New and unpublished test results conducted about the panel summarize the situation. The booster rocket joint began to fail at temperature as high as 50 degrees. NASA officials said they were confident the crew would suffer no undue risk during the launch for lower than 50. The launch January 28th was 36 degrees. They estimate the temperature of the joint that operated the O-ring seal was 28 degrees. The test indicated the failure of the O-ring was more likely than not at that temperature. It took a lot of nerve for me 2 weeks after the Challenger disaster, when people were into such deep mourning and so many explanations were given, for me to say and give an entire hour on why I think it was allowed to purposely blow up and what would happen as a consequence of the blow-ups. And now they're ready to wind up their report, and they're talking about the cold and the effect on the O-rings. And one quotation said, the investigators believe two segments of the Challenger's right-hand booster were poorly matched, greatly increasing the probability of disaster. Another May 1st story in the LA Times, wreckage confirms joint failure, top investigator says. And again, it goes into the failure of the O-ring to seal on the shuttle, most certainly due to faulty design and to the near-freezing weather the morning of the launch, and they go into the very cold weather. This article was May the 1st, 1986. Another one from the New York Times, new tests prove cold-made shuttle seal failure inevitable. That's what we had on World Watchers, and I'm not even a scientific expert on how to build a space shuttle that is safe, but all of this was so obvious. Another article, which I don't think many of you have seen, it comes from a listener in Texas. She sends me wonderful articles from the Houston Post. This is April 19th. Diploma fraud worries Claude Pepper. 3 phony degrees at NASA. Claude Pepper from Florida was concerned Friday over FBI allegations that 3 men with phony engineering degrees from a diploma mill work in sensitive positions at 2 USA space centers. It disturbs me that NASA people were involved. There were a list of 72 federal employees and government contractors. 3 worked at Houston and Cape Canaveral space centers. And this, again, is like the explosion in the Soviet Union, where people could allow and sabotage that to happen. And again, briefly, this was allowed to happen. They could test the O-rings in the cold weather. And also, they want to eliminate all the frills and make space for the military, because now that we've lost this shuttle, the priority is the military. And you couldn't do that unless you had a visual examination of what happened in losing one shuttle and the necessity of tightening up and turning it to the military. There was an article in the Houston Post sent to me by a friend who sends me these wonderful items on space, particularly in that area that we don't get in other papers. And this was Houston Post, April 19th. Diploma fraud worries Claude Pepper. And he's referring to 3 phony degrees at NASA, or 3 that he knew about, given to him by the FBI. And these are 3 men that have something to do with the launching, bringing back the boosters, who have fake degrees among 72 names published last Friday. There were those alleged to be an operations engineer and section chief for the post-launch operations with the United States Booster Company at Cape Canaveral, who had no degree in engineering. And Claude Pepper said that there's a bogus bachelor of science degree in electrical engineering of a particular person in the aerospace with an important role. And another scientist who did not go to engineering school, who has a phony degree, who was part of the group to bring in the shuttle's reusable boosters after they were recovered from the flight. And Claude Pepper was worried about these phony PhDs. Another fellow working at Johnson Space Center in Houston in aerospace electrical engineering, they evidently wrote their own degrees and had them printed or published. There are mills to give you degrees in these things, and then they're in key positions. That can be very important in matters such as the blowing up of the, not with a phony degree, but sabotage in Russia with their atomic reactors, and also with the shuttle program where you have people in key positions who obviously are placed there for some reason and don't have degrees and aren't selected very carefully. That's why I think they're there for a purpose. We'll take a one-minute break and then continue with some more of these news stories. There are so many of them, and I think you all would agree on that.